6 p.m. on the fourth Monday of the month.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, I guess I have to start with the top news today, and that's Freedom Gas. In an effort to suppress federal climate research, the Trump administration will direct state agencies to no longer consider worst-case scenarios of global warming. That's the latest freedom gas that's being spread around. But what I mean by freedom gas is that the Trump administration has decided to rename natural gas. I swear I am not making this up. The announcement this week came with the title, Department of Energy Authorizes Additional LNG Exports from Freeport LNG. Article by Alex Johnson. And NBC News says, Department of Energy, increasing export capacity from Freeport LNG project is critical to spreading freedom gas throughout the world. By giving America's allies a diverse and affordable source of clean energy. And yeah, that's real now. Of course, you remember Freedom Fries. And I just can't think of a better gift to the political world than Freedom Gas. Freedom Gas is, of course, what comes out of Donald Trump's mouth whenever he gets a chance. And Freedom Gas is what we can expect from Mitch McConnell, etc. We're all going to be hearing about freedom gas. Anyway, an article from The Guardian, which is a lousy source of information on Julian Assange, by the way, but has many good articles. In an effort to suppress federal climate research, the Trump administration will direct state agencies to no longer consider worst-case scenarios of global warming. Climate modelers working for federal agencies will only be permitted to forecast to 2040, decades before the as much as 8 degrees centigrade degrees of global warming that could take place by 2100 if we continue on our current path. William Happer, most recently famous for complaining that the demonization of carbon dioxide really differs little from the Nazi persecution of the Jews. Persecution, that is. And once again, I didn't make that up. Will lead a team charged with reviewing the science produced by government researchers, no doubt hunting for references to the disastrous sea level rise, crop failures, and health impacts continued warming stands to create. The irony in all of this, they write, is that Trump, Happer, and company may have a firmer grasp on the epic scope of these climate projections than many Democrats. As Naomi Klein argues, even the right's fervent conspiracy theorists tend to understand at some level how profound the implications of this crisis are for business as usual, which has distributed its profits among elites of both parties. Klein has written, quote, members of Trump's cabinet, with their desperate need to deny the reality of global warming or belittle its implications, nonetheless understand something that is fundamentally true. To avert climate chaos, we need to challenge the free market fundamentalism that has conquered the world since the 1980s, end quote. And, of course, that comes from her books, and I must agree. It is an existential crisis for those who have grown rich from petroleum profits. And right now, they are winning, in a sense, if you look at the climate change as a war from the petroleum profit elites and the rest of us, if you look at it as a war between those who can afford infinitely expensive bunkers and the other 99.99% of us, they're winning. And we see the evidence of global warming all around us. If I need to remind you of the hurricane that just sat on Houston and drowned it, of the fires last year, of the 500 tornadoes that have danced across the nation's midsection, the climate horror is here and now. So I'm going to return to this article in The Guardian. For all their bluster and junk science, Republican decision makers have a clear sense for their own self-interest and just how much is at stake for them and the rest of the 1%. Consider Happer himself, a retired physicist who has spent his post-academy days hopping between various climate-denying think tanks, a good many of them funded by the fossil fuel industry. And it's freedom gas! Well, I couldn't resist adding that in there. You're going to be hearing a lot about freedom gas. We can't know whether Happer believes the nonsense he's spouting, they write, or is just being paid well enough to sound like he does. In 2015, Greenpeace activists duped Happer into agreeing to write a report on the benefits of carbon dioxide for a fictional oil company. The real coal company, Peabody Energy, has paid him to deliver testimony at a state hearing in Minnesota, and Happer has joined hands with groups like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, all recipients of ample industry funding, by which the writer means the Koch brothers in the case of the Cato Institute, and maybe more, to bolster Trump's agenda and cast doubt on the scientific consensus. As the New York Times reported in its article on the White House new climate plans, both Happer and John Bolton, who tapped him for the administration, have received generous support from the Mercers, the right-wing family credited with both spreading climate denial and helping fuel the opioid epidemic. So there's more on that article. You can find it at The Guardian. And I think this is an example of my philosophy in looking at news. The Guardian has some great reporting and some awesome reporters. We've had them pass through these studios, and I'm impressed by a lot of the things I can find in what used to be called the Manchester Guardian. They just outright slander Julian Assange, which is a little ironic and I think a little criminal, because after all, they have profited directly from Assange's journalistic research. Now, this is the news you're not supposed to know, and so I feel obligated to pass on the words as direct as we can get them from North Korea. Things have gone sour, and the U.S. press doesn't seem to be quite up to speed on that. Before I read this, it sounds a little dire, I also want to say that I checked the South Korean press, which is pretty much keeping the same temperature. So despite these words, I suppose an invasion is not imminent. Anyway, from KCNA, the policy research director of the Institute for American Studies of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the DPRK, that's North Korea, made public the following press statement on May 29th. It has now become disclosed that the United States conducted the 29th subcritical nuclear test at the nuclear test ground of Nevada on February 13th, causing grave apprehension and invoking the denunciation of the international community. What should be taken as seriously is the fact that the test was carried out in the run-up to the Hanoi, North Korea-U.S. summit, which would discuss the matter of building a lasting and durable peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. has thus revealed its ulterior intention to seek an arms-based solution of the issues, although it is outwardly advocating dialogue. Continuing with the North Korean press release, that intention can be fully justified by the political, economic, and militarily hostile acts committed by the U.S. against the DPRK, its dialogue partner, since the historic Singapore DPRK-U.S. summit talks. And once again, since you're not used to it, DPRK is North Korea. Even after the U.S. committed to an establishment of new North Korea-U.S. relations in the June 12th DPRK-U.S. joint statement, Bolton, White House National Security Advisor Pompeo, Secretary of State, and other high-ranking officials of the U.S. diplomacy and security circles have insulted the dignity of our supreme leadership and let loose a stream of invective and abuse against the DPRK, branding it as a rogue regime. It has also resorted to its hostile schemes aimed at stifling us by force, saying that it would change its path if the DPRK does not give in to its demand for the dismantlement of the nuke first. This translation tends, it's gotten even clumsier over the years, and I've tried to soften it a bit. But this is what you can get in English, basically, from North Korea. Continuing with the press release, at the same time, the U.S. has continued to pursue its strategy of maximum pressure against DPRK and attempted to suffocate it economically. Since August 2018, it has imposed arbitrary sanctions for 11 times on more than 40 entities and individuals from many countries, including the DPRK, China, Russia, Singapore, and South Africa, continued to change the regulations on the anti-North Korea sanctions and made public advisories of all colors on several occasions so as to impose the financial and shipping embargoes against the DPRK. Worse still, they write, it has committed a crime of dispossessing our cargo ship under the preposterous ground that we had violated the heinous American Sanctions Acts. At present, it is moving in a crafty manner to impose additional sanctions on our ships, organizations, and individuals and set limits to legitimate activities of our diplomats by employing the Anti-DPRK Sanctions Committee of the United Nations Security Council. Continuing with the press release, it has also militarily threatened the DPRK by staging Marine Corps Joint Exercise Dongmang 2019, joint aerial combat drills, and other various war games in collusion with South Korea last November as well as in March and April of this year. From March to May of this year, it conducted a missile interception test simulating the interception of the DPRK's ICBMs at the Air Force Base in California, by which I suppose they mean Vandenberg. Test launched ICBM Minuteman III's and SLBM Trident II D5 missiles targeted at the DPRK and its neighboring countries and made a scouting flight over North Korea. It also makes such moves to deploy sophisticated landing crafts in Japan and SLCM missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads around the Korean Peninsula. All the facts clearly show, they write, that the U.S. has never changed its wild ambition to conquer DPRK by force, despite the June 12th DPRK-U.S. joint statement. They write, when clouds are frequent, rain will follow. The U.S. should better bear in mind that it's hostile acts will only result in exacerbating the tension of the present unstable Korean Peninsula situation and in generating adverse currents. Use of strength is not at all a monopoly of the United States. And that's the end of their communication from the official North Korean English language site. I've altered it slightly to make it a bit more comprehensible. It should put the lie to the idea that Trump has things in hand or that peace has broken out. They've gone back to this sort of rhetoric, which means that the honeymoon is over, so to speak. The phrase, when clouds are frequent, rain will follow, of course, is the equivalent of, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And they're saying that they're not fooled by the Trump administration. Now, I said that South Korea is not acting alarmed about this, nor should they just from a statement. It's back to business as usual before the Trump talks. And I want to remind you of something, though, that in looking at the North Korean situation over all of these years, it's become pretty clear to me that in the outbreak of hostilities, if North Korea gets so much as a one-hour lead, they will win the war. They have far more men under arms. They have an effective plan. They have many, many more tunnels than people have realized before. They will overwhelm, and there will be one Korea if they decide to go to war. And they will decide to go to war if they think that it's a choice between that and being obliterated by the United States. And one more thing. They're very hungry. And that doesn't help things. Now, turning to other headlines, I want to talk about the Mueller statement yesterday, which you may have heard about, but I want to frame it from the World Socialist editorial, or at least part of it. Their title is, Mueller Encourages the Drive to Remove Trump. In a surprise statement Wednesday, they write, Special Counsel Robert Mueller provided ammunition to the sections of the American ruling class that have concluded it is necessary to remove President Donald Trump from office prior to the 2020 elections. Mueller appeared before the press to make his first public statement of the two-year investigation, and he headed into supposed Russian interference in the 2016 elections and possible collusion and obstruction of justice by Trump and his advisors. The former FBI director hewed closely to the wording in the report he issued on April 18th, but he pointedly contradicted White House claims that his report exonerated Trump of criminal violations. Mueller stressed that he could not charge Trump with a criminal offense due to longstanding Justice Department rules barring the indictment of a sitting president for federal crimes, but he did not clear Trump of criminal obstruction of justice, suggesting, on the contrary, that were it not for the Justice Department policy, he would have indicted the president. The retiring special counsel said, quote, If we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit any crime, we would have said that. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime, end quote. He then essentially invited Congress to launch impeachment proceedings against the president, saying that, quote, the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing, end quote. Hint, hint. They didn't write that, but that's what he's saying. He's saying, this is what I've done. I can't indict the president. Therefore, you must begin impeachment proceedings. But returning to the article, Mueller, a longtime fixture in the U.S. intelligence and police establishment, made his intervention as the spokesman for a growing faction within the ruling class in the state that is losing confidence in the ability of Trump to manage the affairs, international and domestic, of U.S. imperialism. And so there's more to their editorial, and I encourage you to find it by pulling up WSWS.org. It's that easy. And it is utterly downvoted, and you will never find it in your Facebook feed or other social media, because it's we live in that world now in which dissent is downvoted and kind of disappears, and you're much more likely to find expressions of freedom gas. God bless freedom gas. Well, it's 17 minutes after the top of the hour, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is the news you're not supposed to know. Press watch. And I invite your calls on these topics. I have a lot of headlines, news, and I want to get to a commentary on the intersection of the anti-transgender erasure push. I should rephrase that. The anti-transgender push, the attempt at erasure that I'm now experiencing and all transgender Americans are now experiencing. And what it has to do with imperialism, what it has to do with maintaining control over you and moving towards the new edge of civil war America. But first, more news. This also from World Socialist, WSWS.org. The Trotskyists, they make good editorials and good reporting, and you should look them up. Oscar Grenfell writes, WikiLeaks issued a statement today confirming that its founder, Julian Assange, has been transferred to the medical ward of Britain's Belmarsh prison. The media organization has said it has grave concerns about the state of health of our publisher. It reported, quote, During the 7 weeks in Belmarsh, his health has deteriorated and he has dramatically lost weight. The decision of prison authorities to transfer him to the health ward speaks for itself, end quote. The statement must sound the alarm for all defenders of democratic rights. The British authorities' detention of Assange at Belmarsh Prison, a maximum security facility dubbed the UK's Guantanamo, is a continuation of the 8-year campaign by the US government and its allies to physically and psychologically destroy the WikiLeaks founder. It is part of the ongoing denial of Assange's fundamental legal and human rights, aimed at preventing him from mounting any defense against the unprecedented U.S. Espionage Act charges over WikiLeaks' exposure of war crimes, mass surveillance operations, and global diplomatic conspiracies. The World Socialist website and the Socialist Equality parties around the world demand Assange's immediate release from prison. The WikiLeaks founder must be taken to a hospital with the best medical care available, provided with doctors selected by himself, his colleagues, and lawyers, and allowed to recuperate and fully recover his health. All those involved in his persecution are fully responsible for the ill health Assange is suffering and must be held legally accountable for any harm that comes to him. And the World Socialists also write, the broadest mobilization of workers, students, young people, and supporters of civil liberties is required to secure Assange release. WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Kristen Hafsson, I can't say it right, wrote today, quote, the people need to voice their condemnation. It is their politicians, their courts, their police, and their prisons that are being abused in order to leave this black stain on history. Please act now to avert this shame. There's much more to the article at wsws.org. And by the way, when you read in The Guardian that Assange has been charged with rape, you're simply reading a lie. He hasn't been charged with rape. An investigation is ongoing, and he hasn't been charged. Now, I'd like to thank Aaron for a couple of items here. This is from a local provider of housing for persons who are currently houseless. They write, there have been a number of recent stories coming out of Washington, D.C. that have direct implications for the people we serve. Yesterday, HUD announced its intention to change the Equal Access Rule that ensures that shelters do not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. The Trump administration has indicated that it intends to allow shelters to discriminate for reasons as vague as, quote, practical concerns, end quote. You can assure participants, this is a message intended for the staff of this housing organization, you can assure participants that even if Equal Access Rule were to change, our policies will not. Recently, HUD introduced a rule change to prohibit mixed-status immigrant families from living in public and subsidized housing. This proposed HUD rule would require that all members of a household receiving financial assistance are U.S. citizens. At its core, this rule will bar housing a human right from any family that has even one loved one without citizenship. So you can see how that is going to be used by right-wing religious organizations and just right-wing organizations to deny housing to transgender people and to people coming up from the Southern Cone already facing so much oppression, including having their children shunted around in cages. Now, to focus more on the attempted erasure of transgender Americans, and by the way, the number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. This article, House LGBT Caucus denounces administration's new rule to allow anti-transgender discrimination in homeless shelters. The Congressional LGBT Equality Caucus today denounced a new rule from the Trump administration that would allow anti-transgender discrimination in homeless shelters. The Department of Housing and Urban Development announced the proposed rule last Wednesday, which would roll back protections for transgender people experiencing homelessness by allowing taxpayer-funded shelters to turn away transgender people, based on a number of factors, including the shelter provider's religious views. The proposed rule comes one day after Secretary of HUD Ben Carson assured members of Congress the agency had no plans to eliminate or revise the 2012 Equal Access Rule, which bars federal housing discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Quoting, as the former executive director of California's largest homeless services nonprofit, this is a quote of LGBT Equality Caucus co-chair Representative Katie Hill from California. Quote, I have personally seen how disproportionately transgender individuals, especially trans people of color, experience housing instability and homelessness. The effects are devastating. While we face a growing crisis across our country, it seems that this administration's priority is enabling discrimination instead of getting as many people into stable housing as possible. This rule does not reflect our American values, and we will do everything in our power to stop it from going into effect, end quote. The proposed rule will endanger the lives of transgender people, particularly transgender people of color, who disproportionately experience homelessness. According to the U.S. Transgender Survey, nearly one-third of transgender and gender non-binary people experience homelessness at some point in their lives, putting them at risk of physical and sexual violence. 70% of transgender people who tried going to a shelter in the last year, 70%, were kicked out for being transgender, were physically or sexually assaulted, or faced another form of mistreatment because of their gender identity. Once again, the numbers call 503-231-8187. 87. This is KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You're listening to Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. And I want to explain for a minute the connections and dynamics between the seemingly random aggression by the Trump administration against transgender persons and the growing threat of fascism and civil war in this country. First, you should know that I am a transgender woman. I've lived as a woman for 18 years now. The changes in the society's attitudes, from incomprehension and rejection to gradual acceptance to an increasingly divided and rage-filled backlash, are evident to me. The worst of it is being experienced by black trans women who are being viciously murdered. These killings are marked by a berserk fury, as if the killers would erase the memory and the very idea of a trans woman. There are still, in many states, effective legal defenses for the murderer of trans women, a sort of temporary insanity status that the jury is encouraged to see as normal. That sort of rage is also now being put to use politically, so keep that blind fury in mind for a moment. I want to talk about Stephen Miller, the hate czar for the United States. Stephen Miller, Trump administration's senior policy advisor, has made a name for himself as a director of official hatred. He's been active in directing evil attitudes towards everyone except white cis males since he was a young white cis male. He is still a young man. But he is quite experienced and educated in his quest to impose, or reimpose if you prefer, absolute white supremacy on this nation. He is known for a certain sullen affect of the face, the one the Germans call Backpfeifengesicht, that is, a face that demands to be punched. Pull up his photo and you'll see what I mean. His face is the one aspect of his being that does not lie. He has had quite a string of policy successes. He has survived and by all accounts directed the purge of others attempting to serve the capricious whims of his fascist-in-chief. The multi-nation ban on Muslims, the furor over the proposed border wall, the puerile reaction to NFL players' gentle protests against racist killings, the abhorrent effort to absolve war atrocities, the coddling and promotion of violent racist mobs, whether with torches or motorcycles, the false accusation of illegal voting by non-whites are all promoted, encouraged, or even instigated by Stephen Miller. So you need to know that name. This is not to say that Stephen Miller has not found fertile ground to work with. His boss was known for wildly racist and sexist behavior long before he met Miller. The pussy-grabbing birther in turn was elected by a slight minority of people who found such attitudes to their liking. Indeed, Trump's constant rallies are marked by a certain glassy-eyed fascist glee. This again comes from an evil rage. It is the rage that Miller understands and wishes to foster and fester. It is the first spark of an emotion that can be fermented into an explosive libidinal frenzy. And that's a phrase I want to lay on you as well. The libidinal social frenzy. It is well known to students of genocide. It is described as a joyful and liberating emotion that arises from the gut during a mass rally, where one participates in a loud, vocal, and collective focus of murderous rage that is similar to, but much more severe than, the joyous shouts of sports fans as their champion pummels his victim in the boxing ring. This libidinal rage, pardon me, is essential to those who direct mass murders and genocides. The participants must be led en masse to feel that they are as one, that they as one body are aggrieved to an existential level, that their suffering is legitimate and pitiable, and that their misdirected rage is actually an heroic and even divine righteousness, and most importantly, that their intended victims are vile, unredeemable, inferior, insidious, and guilty. This blind fury, this libidinal rage, is the principal crop in the garden that Stephen Miller is keeping in Trump's White House. With it, he can turn a dwindling political base, the Trump Republicans, into an intimidating juggernaut. The target is not only the minds of the participants, whose loyalty waxes brighter with each flag-flapping rally, but the fear that the rest of us feel when viewing this sort of horror. To fan these flames, to work up to a more general libidinal frenzy, it is important to find victims who cannot effectively answer. Someone to start with. Victims who cannot respond with numbers nor with a well-established and comfortable niche in society. One of the best victims for the Stephen Miller Trump rule by terror is, therefore, the transgender person. This brings me back to the legal defense of those who murder individual trans women. Often the murderer is a lover or a John who wishes to absolve himself of his attraction to transgenderism. This absolution is accomplished first through a violent murder and then through the framing of that murder in court as the act of an innocent who has been tainted and violated by a sneaking imposter, someone who would infect him with a wrong sexuality, a wolf and sheep's clothing a transgender woman. The murderers in these cases actually represent a cast of sexual orientation that is hidden, invisible, despised, rejected, and erased by their own communities. The fact is, they prefer and need trans women to experience satisfying sexual relations, but when they are caught in that act, or when something goes wrong in any way with a relationship, they know that they can act out their mord list and then claim to have been trapped into defending their honor. The society, the jurors, don't want to give any legitimacy to the fact that trans women are desired in these cases, and so, of course, the murderer doesn't want to be punished, so an agreement is reached. Conveniently, the trans woman's perspective in such a case is silenced forever. In the societal transformation that Stephen Miller envisions, a fraction of the masses can participate in the violent expungement of transgender persons. This will seal their loyalty to the great leader. It will create a joyful community of righteous, pure, avenging angels who stand guard against the foul degeneration of that, the foul degeneration that trans persons represent. These shining heroes, confident in the approval and protection of the police and the newly purged and pure military, can consummate their desires and be certain that they will be admired for it. For now, the killings go on in motel rooms or in dark streets, and the police can do their part by looking the other way. And this go on for a while, as we've seen. But the goal is for that glorious day when the glass is smashed in the open and the cleansing can be done in the light of the smiling sun. Now, I have more to say about leading a society towards acts of genocide and how experienced this society is in that. But right now I'm going to talk to Dennis. The number to call, 503-231-8187.
Hello.
Hello there. Right.
Am I on the air?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, Steve Miller comes from a family of immigrants, and actually Amy Goodman had his uncle on her show, and his uncle actually condemns what he's doing. I don't know. Did you know this?
Yes, it's an ironic thing, and they seem to be shocked and embittered by it.
Yes, that's right. I just wanted people to know that his family, I don't know how many in his family, are actually against what he's doing. And I find that he doesn't seem to care. Okay, well, that's all I'd had to say. I don't know whether people knew this. I just thought I'd put that out there.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
You seem to know it. Right. Did you hear that show of hers? It was a while back that she did this show which had his uncle on it.
I don't think I encountered it that way. I think I came across that in print.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Well, I'm talking about the attempted erasure of transgender persons. The military is being cleansed, if you will, and I use that phrase advisedly, of transgender persons. The bathroom controversy is being used with the pretense that transgender people are actually vile predators. And, the Trump administration formally proposed on Friday to roll back Obama-era civil rights safeguards that had banned discrimination against transgender medical patients and health insurance customers. So you can't get housing. And now there is a movement to keep transgender people from getting medical care. The Department of Health, and of course, before I go further, I want to say, of course, this affects a majority of trans women because we have been excluded from jobs, from housing. We have been on the streets, and now this circle is becoming more complete. Healthcare is being denied. To continue, the Department of Health and Human Services proposed regulation would replace a 2016 rule from the Obama administration that defined discrimination on the basis of sex to include gender identity. The Trump administration rule would no longer recognize gender identity as an avenue for sex discrimination. Without the Obama-era language, healthcare workers would be free to object to performing procedures like gender reassignment surgery, and insurers would not be bound to cover all services for transgender customers. The new rule would fit into a broader agenda pushed by religious activists and is consistent with administration actions to limit civil rights protections for gay and transgender Americans in a variety of domains, including education, employment, and housing. And of course, there's a whole array of persons. Just about everyone who is not a white cis male is under attack by this administration. Skipping ahead in that article, the Trump-Pence administration's latest attack threatens to undermine crucial non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people provided for under the Affordable Care Act. According to David Stacey, the Government Affairs Director for the Human Rights Campaign, said that in a statement. And by the way, I think I forgot to mention this is from the New York Times. The administration, quoting Stacey again, the administration puts LGBTQ people at greater risk of being denied necessary and appropriate health care solely based on their sexual orientation or gender identity, quote, end quote. Last year, Mr. Severino pushed for a legal definition of sex under Title IX, the federal civil rights law that bans gender discrimination in education programs that receive government financial assistance. Quoting that memo, sex means a person's status as male or female based on the immutable biological traits identifiable by or before birth. The sex listed on a person's birth certificate as originally issued shall constitute definitive proof of a person's sex unless rebutted by reliable genetic evidence, end quote. Now, here again, I got to speak for myself. There's not always... genetics is still a new science. Epigenetics is just now being understood. In my case, I appeared to be fully male when I was born. But I was not. I was and am, in fact, a hermaphrodite, or to be more specific, pseudo-hermaphrodite. One of my testicles failed... actually blew up to the size of a baseball when I was a kid. It wasn't plumbed right. And when puberty came around, the ovotestis, combined male and female organ, destroyed itself. It was rather painful, as you can imagine. It also turns out that I have uterine tissue. Both lobes of my uterus are partially functioning and are attached to the base of my ureter. And when that was found on a CAT scan, the health provider that I went to attempted to gaslight me and told me that he had found nothing. And it was effective. I thought that I was mad because, like most women, I bleed periodically. And without checking, without doing anything scientific, in fact, he gave me a massive antibiotic on the assumption that I had a bad sexually transmitted disease. Well, I didn't. The antibiotic wiped out all of my good bacteria and caused a fungal outbreak in my skin, which took a year to cure. That's how hard some people within the medical community will push to erase transgender persons. And now that they have encouragement from the Trump administration, I know there'll be many more stories like mine, and I know that they will not end as well, because I am a thriving person. I can thank my partner for that. I can thank more enlightened medical personnel for that, and my desire for life. But a lot of people, a lot of trans people, are going to kill themselves when they get erased at every turn and in every place, and that is the idea. And it is also the idea to encourage people who would kill them, because we know historically that killers of trans people can get off light or can get off entirely. So this is my warning. The genocidal aspect of American fascism of the Trump administration is now moving forward rapidly. Every aspect of existence for transgender people is being challenged. So I'm going to move past the New York Times article. Well, actually, I think I'll go to the end of it. It says, quotes Mara Kiesling, Executive Director of National Center for Transgender Equality. She says, quote, what this does from a very practical point of view is it empowers bad actors to be bad actors, end quote. She added that already transgender people, quote, are turned away from ERs, dismissed by insurers, and mocked by untrained hospital staff, all while trying to seek the care every American deserves, end quote. Time is 9:38, and I want to talk about the 10 stages of genocide. This is by Gregory H. Stanton, president of Genocide Watch. It was originally the 8 stages, and it was presented as a paper to the State Department. So I am going to alter this freely. I'm going to truncate it in part because part of it is about mobilizing armed forces to prevent genocide in other nations. And generally, the document is stonily and I suppose deliberately ignorant of the genocides and the effect of the genocides that have gone on this soil. Nevertheless, The first stage of genocide is classification. All cultures have categories to distinguish people into us and them by ethnicity, race, religion, or nationality. German and Jew, Hutu and Tutsi, black and white, Indian and settler, cis and trans, immigrant and citizen. Bipolar societies, he writes, that lack mixed categories, such as Rwanda and Burundi, are the most likely to have a genocide. The main preventive measure at this early stage is to develop universalistic institutions that transcend ethnic or racial divisions and that actively promote tolerance and understanding, that promote classifications that transcend the divisions. The Catholic Church could have played this role in Rwanda had it not been riven by the same ethnic cleavages as Rwandan society. Promotion of a common language in countries like Tanzania has also promoted transcendent national identity. The search for common ground is vital to early prevention of genocide. Second, symbolization. But just to emphasize that we're going on a 10-stage set, starting with the mildest to the actual act. The first one, again, was classification. Second is symbolization, second of 10. We give names or other symbols to the classifications. We name people Jews or Gypsies or distinguish them by colors or dress and apply the symbols to members of the group. Classification and symbolization are not universally human and do not necessarily result in genocide unless they lead to dehumanization. When combined with hatred, symbols may be forced upon unwilling members of the pariah groups. The yellow star for Jews under Nazi rule, the blue scarf for people in the Eastern Zone in Khmer Rouge, Cambodia, and I'll add the electronic tracker bracelet on immigrants. To combat symbolization, hate symbols can be legally forbidden. In, for example, swastikas as hate speech can be. Group marking like gang clothing or tribal scarring can be outlawed as well. The problem is that legal limitations will fail if unsupported by popular cultural effacement. Though Hutu and Tutsi were forbidden words in Burundi until the 1980s, code words replaced them. And as I said, I'm updating and improving this for our usage. They talk about code words. Let's talk about liberal, snowflake, cuck, abortionist. If widely supported, he writes, however, denial of symbolization can be powerful, as it was in Bulgaria, where the government refused to supply enough yellow badges, and at least 80% of Jews did not wear them, decrying the yellow star of its significance as a Nazi symbol for Jews in that area. Third, okay, so we talked about classification and symbolization. The third is discrimination. A dominant group uses law, custom, and political power to deny the rights of other groups. And I would argue this is where we are at in the upcoming genocide of transgender persons. The third step, discrimination. A dominant group uses law, custom, and political power to deny the rights of other groups. The powerless group may not be accorded full civil rights or even citizenship. Examples include the Nuremberg Laws of 1935 in Nazi Germany, which stripped Jews of their German citizenship and prohibited their employment by the government and by universities. Denial of citizenship to the Rohingya Muslim minority in Burma is another example. Treatment of indigenous people in the U.S. is another. Japanese internment in World War II is another. The Trump administration edicts against trans equality are another. Slavery and Jim Crow and mass incarceration and police murders are refusal to pay reparations are also in that category. Prevention against discrimination means full political empowerment and citizen rights for all groups in a society. Discrimination on the basis of nationality, ethnicity, race, or religion should be outlawed. Individuals should have the right to sue the state, corporations, or other individuals if their rights are violated. So, that's three stages of 10. Classification, symbolization, discrimination, and now the fourth, dehumanization. One group denies the humanity of the other group. Members of it are equated with animals, vermin, insects, or diseases called satanic. Dehumanization overcomes the normal human revulsion against murder. At this stage, hate propaganda in print and on hate radios is used to vilify the victim group. Think Fox News. In combating this dehumanization, incitement to genocide should not be confused with protected speech. And he goes on to describe that. Now I'll go to the fifth category, organization. Genocide is always organized, usually by the state, often using militias to deny ability of state responsibility. the example given, the Janjaweed in Darfur, but I will add the Klan and the National Guard versus Black Americans in Tulsa in 1921. Sometimes organizations informal, Hindu mobs led by local RSS militants, or decentralized terrorist groups. Special army units or militias are often trained and armed plans are made for genocidal killings. To combat this stage, membership in these militias should be outlawed. Their leaders should be denied visas for foreign travel. The UN should impose arms embargoes on governments and citizens of countries involved in genocidal massacres and create commissions to investigate violations, as was done in post-genocide Rwanda. Now, if this fifth stage of the 10 stages of genocide were recognized and acted on properly, then members of the Klan would be denied visas for foreign travel. They would be recognized as a terrorist group. They are a terrorist group. Just there's no other way to describe them. They exist for terror, race terror. Sixth, polarization. Extremists drive the groups apart. Hate groups broadcast polarizing propaganda. Laws may forbid intermarriage or social interaction. Extremist terrorism targets moderates, intimidating and silencing the center. Moderates from the perpetrator's own group are most able to stop genocide, so are the first to be arrested and killed. Prevention may mean security protection for moderate leaders or assistance to human rights groups. Assets of extremists may be seized. Again, we have genocidalist terrorists in this country, and we do not act against them. The seventh level, preparation. National or perpetrator group leaders plan the final solution to the Jewish, Armenian, Tutsi, or other targeted group question. They often use euphemism to cloak their intentions, such as referring to their goals as ethnic cleansing, purification, or counterterrorism. They build armies, buy weapons, and train their troops and militias. They indoctrinate the populace with the fear of the victim group. Leaders often claim, if we don't kill them, they will kill us. Eighth level, persecution. Victims are identified and separated out because of their ethnic or religious identity. Death lists are drawn up. In state-sponsored genocide, members of victim groups may be forced to wear identifying symbols. Ninth level, extermination begins and quickly becomes a mass killing legally called genocide. It is extermination to the killers because they do not believe their victims to be fully human. When it is sponsored by the state, the armed forces often work with militias to do the killing. Tenth level of genocide, denial. A final stage that lasts throughout and always follows a genocide, it is among the surest indicators of further genocidal massacres. The perpetrators of the genocide dig up the mass graves, burn the bodies, try to cover up the evidence, and intimidate the witnesses. They deny that they committed any crimes and often blame what happened on the victims. This has certainly been the mark of U.S. genocides. They block investigations of the crimes and continue to govern until driven from power by force when they flee into exile. So those are 10 stages of genocide. And you can find them. It was originally presented as a briefing paper, Eight Stages of Genocide, and presented to the U.S. State Department in 1996. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And again, I say that we are on the third level of genocide against transgender Americans. And that third level is the discrimination level. So I want to continue with some facts about some news about what's going on in the U.S. On this topic. The number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Though my skin is on the line here, I don't want to try to make this discrimination against myself and my kind any greater. Certainly it is not as great in many respects so far as the genocides that have taken place on this soil. And that is what makes it more likely that we are moving forward to more than just a backlash. We have the central government of the most powerful nation on earth throwing out every possible hint that you are to remove transgender persons from your life now. And it's gotten that bad. So, quoting an article by Kate Ryan, Dateline New York, from the news organization Openly, LGBT plus advocates filed a lawsuit on Tuesday of this week to block a rule the U.S. government said will allow medical professionals to act according to their consciences, but critics said could deny care to those in need. Under the more than 400-page rule written by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, hospitals and doctors' offices must certify they are protecting employee consciences. and religious rights, or lose federal funding. The so-called conscience rule, which could take effect as early as July, permits health workers to opt out of procedures such as abortions and sterilizations which violate their beliefs. The rule also opens the door to the denial of care for LGBT plus patients seeking surgical transitions or hormone treatment. Jamie Glicksberg, an attorney with LGBT plus rights group Lambda Legal, told that to the Thomson Reuters Foundation. And he is quoted saying, when patients cannot be out to providers about their sexual orientation or gender identity out of fear of being refused treatment, their mental and physical health is critically compromised, end quote. She added that fear of discrimination can prevent patients from seeking out the preventative care that they need or cause them to wait to seek treatment until their needs are acute. Civil rights lawyers also echoed advocate concerns that the broad language in the rule could lead to outright discrimination of LGBT plus patients regardless of the kind of treatment they seek. Genevieve Scott, senior staff attorney for the Center of Reproductive Rights, said that healthcare facilities could be intimidated into ending reproductive care and LGBT plus services altogether for fear of losing government funding. So that's abortion coming into it again. And I want to comment, pardon me just a moment, that there are very organized and violent groups already seeking to impose forced birth on women across the nation, but they are also very much present here in Oregon and in Washington. The state of Gilead, and the fictional state of Gilead, is very much desired by certain persons and militias in the eastern part of Oregon and Washington. And they have prepared and agitated for a civil war that would allow them to create a separate state in which abortion would be absolutely outlawed. And that's something that was a little hard for me to wrap my head around, that that men would get so worked up about abortion that they would want to fight a war over it. But that's real, and that is part of the group that is being agitated and empowered by the Trump administration right now. So it isn't just a matter of medical access. This is a matter of empowering some deeply violent fascist groups. But returning to the article, in response to the lawsuit, HHS pointed to the lengthy process the department had gone through in creating the rule. Speaking for myself, I'm sure they talked to lots of bigots, but quoting them, HHS finalized the conscience rule after more than a year of careful consideration after analyzing over 242,000 public comments. That's according to Roger Severino, director of the Office for Civil Rights. Get that. Some more freedom gas coming out. The Office for Civil Rights at HHS in an emailed statement, he said, quote, "We will defend the rule vigorously," end quote. We will defend the rule vigorously. We will defend the rule vigorously. So it's 9:52. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Of course, there's a lot going on. And the WSWS.org article I was reading previously was referring to the fact that Trump is considered inadequate by our imperialist rulers. And I suppose the only thing worse than being an American is being on the other side of an American gun. And so I want to quote part of what Noam Chomsky says about the John Bolton and Pompeo and Trump's attempt to agitate for a war with Iran. It's titled We Must Stop War with Iran Before It's Too Late. You can find it at inthesetimes.com, inthesetimes.com, also downvoted. Also, you're going to punch that one in yourself, inthesetimes.com. He writes, assuming that rationality prevails and that Bolton and company can be contained, the U.S. will continue with a successful program of crushing Iran's economy and punishing its population. The threat of the U.S. attack on Iran is all too real. Led by John Bolton, the Trump administration is spinning tales of Iranian misdeeds. It is easy to concoct pretexts for aggression. History provides many examples. The assault against Iran is one element of the international program of flaunting overwhelming U.S. power to put an end to successful defiance of the master of the globe, the primary reason for the U.S. torture of Cuba for 60 years. Chomsky writes, the reasoning would be easily understood by any mafia don. Successful defiance can inspire others to pursue the same course. Gee, that should be the motto of my program. Successful defiance can inspire others to pursue the same course. He writes, the virus can spread contagion, as Kissinger put it, when laboring to overthrow Salvador Allende in Chile. The need to destroy such viruses and inoculate victims against contagion, commonly by imposing harsh dictatorships, is a leading principle of world affairs. Iran has been guilty of the crime of successful defiance since the 1979 uprising that deposed the tyrant the U.S. had installed in the 1953 coup that, with help from the British, destroyed the parliamentary system and restored obedience. The achievement was welcomed by liberal opinion. As the New York Times explained in 1954, thanks to the subsequent agreement between Iran and foreign oil companies, quote, underdeveloped countries with rich resources now have an object lesson in the heavy cost that must be paid by one of their number, which goes berserk with fanatical nationalism, end quote. The article goes on to state, is perhaps too much to hope, this is a quote, that Iran's experience will prevent the rise of Mossadegh and other countries, but that experience may at least strengthen the hands of more reasonable and more far-seeing leaders, end quote. And just to give that context in case you don't already know it, Mr. Mossadegh was quite popular. He was elected and he was overthrown by the CIA in concert with the British. They conducted a propaganda program, a whispering program, and they were quite proud of their coup. Destroying democracy and infuriating anyone who cared about, not just democracy, but anyone who cared about their national sovereignty in Iran, and leading to what we have now. But returning to Noam Chomsky, little has changed since. To take another more recent example, Hugo Chavez changed from tolerated bad boy to dangerous criminal when he encouraged OPEC to raise oil prices for the benefit of the global south, the wrong people. Soon after his government was overthrown by a military coup, welcomed by the leading voice of liberal journalism, the Times editor exulted at the time that, quote, Venezuelan democracy is no longer threatened by a would-be dictator. The ruinous demagogue Hugo Chavez, after the military intervened and handed power to a respected business leader, Pedro Carmona, end quote, who quickly dissolved the National Assembly, suspended the Constitution, and disbanded the Supreme Court, but unfortunately was overthrown within days by a popular uprising, compelling Washington to resort to other means to kill the virus. Reading from Noam Chomsky, of course, he's talking about the U.S. current and ongoing attempts to destroy popular sovereignty in Venezuela. Once Iranian successful defiance was terminated and the clear-eyed Shah was safely installed in power, Iran became a pillar of U.S. control in the Middle East, along with Saudi Arabia and the post-1967 Israel, which was closely allied with the Shah's Iran, though not formally. Israel also had shared interests with Saudi Arabia, a relationship now becoming more overt as the Trump administration oversees an alliance of reactionary Middle East states as a base for U.S. power in the region. Control of the strategically significant Middle East with its huge and easily accessible oil reserves has been a centerpiece of policy since the U.S. gained the position of global hegemon after World War II. The reasons are not obscure. The State Department recognized that Saudi Arabia is, quote, a stupendous source of strategic power, and one of the greatest material prizes in world history, end quote. Eisenhower described it as, quote, the most strategically important part of the world, end quote. That control of the Middle East oil yields substantial control of the world and critical leverage over industrial rivals has been understood by an influential statement from Roosevelt advisor A.A. Brill to Zbigniew Brzezinski. These principles hold quite independently of U.S. access to the region's resources, which in fact has not been of primary concern, through much of this period, the U.S. was a major producer of fossil fuels, as it is again today. But the principles remain the same and are reinforced by other factors, among them, Chomsky writes, the insatiable demand of the oil dictatorships for military equipment and the Saudi agreement to support the dollar as global currency, offering the U.S. major advantages. And speaking for myself, to counter the oil hegemons is to save the planet. And to save the planet is something that really irritates and concerns the Trump administration. They want you to stop thinking about that. They want you to forget about Extinction Rebellion. They want you to forget that 350.org exists. They want you to consume the oil and pay the money to the incredibly rich. Returning to Chomsky's comments, Middle East correspondent Tom Stevenson does not exaggerate when he writes that the U.S. inherited mastery of the Gulf has given it a degree of leverage over both rivals and allies probably unparalleled in the history of the empire. It is difficult to overstate the role of the Gulf and the way the world is currently run, end quote. It is, then, understandable why successful defiance in the region cannot be tolerated. Chomsky writes, after the overthrow of its Iranian client, the U.S. turned to direct support for Saddam's invasion of Iran, tacitly condoning his use of chemical weapons and finally intervening directly by protecting Iraqi shipping in the Gulf from Iranian interdiction to ensure Iran's submission. He's talking about the first Gulf War. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, going out to you via 90.7 FM from our great big red and white transmitter on the West Hills and other frequencies in Cascadia, and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is 10 o'clock. Coming up next on the Heather McCoy Show, Heather will talk to Laura Wagner of Deadspin.com to talk about the writer's signing of Richie Incognito, as well as the marketing partnership between the Boston Bruins and Barstool Sports. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman talks to Morgan Parker about her new book, Magical Negro. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Black Queer Pride Celebration on Sunday, June 2nd, from noon to 4:30 p.m. at Multnomah County Central Library in Portland. The Black Queer Pride Celebration explores what it means to be Black, queer, and in Portland with a panel discussion, performances, and more to honor the resilience and uplift the voices of the most marginalized. Again, that's the Black Queer Pride Celebration on Sunday, June 2nd from noon to 4:30 p.m. at Multnomah County Central Library, 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home.